You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Peter Levitt, who is a poet and a longtime friend of mine. We went to college together. He lives here in Los Angeles. These last 2 years have been very good years for him in that two books have come out, as well as what I think is a very beautiful essay in a third book. The two books are 100 Butterflies from Broken Moon Press, Bright Root, Dark Root, also from Broken Moon, and the third is a collection of essays called Beloved of the Sky, and it's a book of essays edited by John Ellison, essays and photographs on clear cutting. I weirdly thought that I'd begin by asking Peter to read a section of his essay called For the Trees, mostly because it provides an easy access to his work. I think that he is a genuinely spiritual poet, and this invocation seems to be a very human acknowledgement of presence and absence, which seems to me to be at the heart of spirit. This is Peter Levitt reading the beginning of his essay, For the Trees.
For the Trees. If a tree falls in the forest and there is no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? Question asked by the humans after they stopped living in forests. 1. If a tree falls in the forest and there is no one there to hear it, it makes a sound. How could there be no one there to hear it? That sound is heard simultaneously in all places around the earth and into the heavens by all things. In that moment when the tree falls, it is the sound of our world. 2. If a whole forest falls in the forest, the sound it makes is unbearable. So unbearable we pretend we can't even hear a single tree when it falls and ask about it, lowering the two bats of our eyes. 3. If a child falls in the forest, any child, your sapling of a girl or a boy or one you are fond of, if this child falls, scraping a limb perhaps, and cries out, and there is no one there to hear it, the sound never leaves you, but flies through the air of you like a wild parrot, repeating its cry. The forest is filled with the parents of these ones, the mothers and fathers who have come there for the comfort, the advice of their elders, the trees, and to find their fallen young. After a while, these parents become birds themselves. You can hear them calling with a 2- or 3-note song. Who's there? Who's there? Is it you? Is it you?
Peter Levitt reading from the beginning of his essay, For the Trees, from the collection Beloved of the Sky. Now, for me, this carries with it a kind of worship of silent presence akin to the poems in your sequence, A Book of Light. And I know that you are a practicing Buddhist.
Yes.
Which came first, Buddhism or poetry?
Well, if Buddhism falls in the forest, will poetry be there to hear it? In my life, I think I would have to answer that silence came first. And because of my deep experience of silence as a child, I was quite sick as a child and spent a lot of time in bed in a dark room because I was quite light sensitive, listening to soft music and having strange hallucinations and seeing things. I learned to sort of try to listen into the world. And consequently, I found that with Buddhism, for example, the silence of Buddhism, and, of course, of the meditation practice, that really seemed quite natural to me. And as far as poetry goes, quite honestly, we think of poetry as the act of speaking or the act of writing something, but for me, poetry is rooted most importantly in the act of listening. In fact, I think listening is the poet's art. And so I would have to say that under the ground of poetry and Buddhism, there's this, not worship, but participation as silence itself for me.
Because I remember years ago when I first met you, I was a bit bewildered by the poets in Buffalo. many of them, you know, were grouped around Robert Creeley, mm-hmm. who was a man I had admired. But my own interest was in prose and fiction, and it took me some time to grow to understand and love poetry. It weirdly came late. And so I often, you're one of the few poets who, it seems to me, still takes seriously the sense of election to poetry mm-hmm. and the poetic figure in the world. And I wondered, it seems to me that in your case, studying poetry and training as a poet had as much to do with writing poetry as learning to live as a poet. Can you talk about that?
I think it's very true what you say, Michael. Let me say first that when it came to writing, I started out as a prose and or fiction writer.
You worked with Kay Boyle,
Kay Boyle, yeah. And I remember, I mean, I've said this before publicly, but I once wrote what I considered to be a one-page novel in which I created the universe, gave it a life, and destroyed it. Uh-huh. And I gave it to Kay Boyle, and she read it, and she said, "This is wonderful, Peter, but what are you going to do on the second page?" It was a clue. The clue was that I needed a form that would more accurately reflect and express my own metabolism, which was very fast as a young man. And so I discovered poetry out of a real bodily need for myself. Once I discovered that, I found that there was a problem that I was having. The problem was that I wanted to study very deeply. I understood study as one of the ways into the world of poetry and into the world of the world, basically, that one studied one's way into life as well as living one's way into life, as well as studying one's life. It's very much, as I say that now, like the practice of meditation where you watch the nature of mind itself. You are mind, but you also watch mind. And so I discovered for myself that I couldn't be a poet when I was writing only and then leave it off and go be something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so gradually the world or the activities of making a living, raising a family, writing poetry, they all really had to come together into one activity, which is called my life. Otherwise, I felt too skitsy. I was all over the place. And frankly, this thing we call spirit or soul or silence was starting to scream at me when I would do things that would in any way injure it.
Now, you teach poetry and have here for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I guess I do want to talk about this. I remember that in those poetry classes back at Buffalo, I guess even by hearing about them,
mm-hmm.
I became aware that a poet has to think differently, or at least it was thought back then, that a poet engaged in activities that were a part of poetry. I remember one teacher talking about breath asked mm-hmm. a student to stand up and whistle and had him continue for the entire duration of the class, wanting to show everyone what breath was doing
mm-hmm.
in the room. I remember at other times...
I'm going to steal that. I haven't thought of that. Do you remember what he whistled?
No, I don't know what he whistled, but I remember it was Jack Clark, the dearly departed Jack Clark, who required this of someone. I remember someone telling me that Charles Olson, also who taught at Buffalo...
Well, of course, you know, Jack was both a Blake scholar and... or is a Blake scholar. I mean, actually, Jack is... right there. And Olson, and of course, was very tuned in to Olson, was a protege of Olson's. and also very interested in the nature of imagination itself in his studies and in his teachings. He would bring that out in the classroom for us. And the breath, of course, which is that basic thing that keeps us alive, how could poetry not be attached to it, was the thinking at the time, of course.
Well, not only that, but of course it's breath that breathed into the vessels of creation makes life. Mm-hmm. And so it was thought at that time that the conscious use of breath was an imitation of the act of creation, part of the act itself.
Yeah, and also the, you know, the thinking, particularly following Charles Olson's sense, this Charles Olson that we're talking about, was that the poem and the form of the poem would vary according to the breath of the poet. For example, if you look at, you mentioned Robert Creeley, if you look at Creeley's poems, you'll see that the poems tend to be very sort of tight-fisted with lots of commas forcing the poem back in on itself, which sort of matches not just his shyness as a person, and he is a shy person, but also the kind of halting but continuous speech that you'll hear when he's just having a conversation as he moves to, through the point of the conversation. He'll do the same thing in the poem. Whereas Olson, who was 6'7" and a huge, expansive man, would come up with those kinds of lines when they were suited to the needs of the poem and the needs of himself as he was working. But also you sometimes find these long lines in which the breath just plays out to give full girth, I feel like saying, to the statement.
Olson, in this line of thought, faced with a student who was speaking using excessive amounts of metaphor, threw an eraser at him and said, "What is it called?" And he said, "Eraser, eraser, it's called an eraser." And Creeley, I remember one summer, used to come in and read the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about the news. All of this whistling, reading the newspaper, hurling objects at students seemed to be a part of learning to be a poet, suggesting that poetry was as much an activity as an act of writing.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I think it is for you as well. So I'm wondering how you teach your students. You've had many years now.
I've been teaching workshops now 3 a week in West Los Angeles area for almost 15 years now, plus at UCLA Extension Writers Program. I try to do, I don't have people whistle, but I might as well. I think I will if any of them are listening. I try to tune people into themselves. I'm much less interested in the product, which we call poem, as I am in the process. I have a lot of faith in the fact that once a poet who takes herself or himself seriously as poet and makes that kind of sincere dedication to the act and the fact of being a poet in the world, and I'm reminded now that that in the, Ezra Pound pointed out that the Chinese character for sincerity is a two-part character. On the left side, it shows a person, and on the right side, it shows a word. So it's a person standing by their word. That's the image of the poet. That's an image of authenticity. And so I try in the writing, when I find people moving away from some authentic experience and or expression, I'm very famous for saying, "I know you would like a cigarette break, but back into the moment in which you were about to tell the truth. And here's where you left it. I can tell the poem goes slack right here. The emotion disappears. The nature of the language starts to sound a little too fancy to me." So there's a way in which we're actually doing the same thing. I feel like saying I was well trained by those poets to, and at the time we felt like apprentices. They were clearly the poets. We were clearly the students. There was no sense of competition. We were there to learn from them, and they were very generous in their teachings. I try to bring that same spirit to students of mine in the private workshops that I teach. Always back to the source. You'll find yourself there. Trust it. Give your imagination, give your unconscious the message that you care enough to go to it, to drink from it, to want to hear what it has to tell you.
This brings me to something that you said in an interview several years ago. You mentioned that you don't rewrite poems much. That
very
you may
little.
Score them with commas or directions that inflect the poem, but that the poem itself comes out of a process of sensitivity to language and event that is either there or not there.
Mm-hmm.
This suggests then in turn that to be a poet requires years of training in that sensitivity.
Okay. Yes, I think that at least to be this poet, or to write from that same kind of approach to writing. There are many ways to approach writing. I mean, there are people who would say, no, that has nothing to do with anything. We just bring in William Burroughs' cut-up method and just cut up stuff and find perfectly good poems in that sense of what a poem might be. For me, I think that the more aware... No, I want to change that. The greater your screen of receptivity, the greater the possibility that an authentic statement, which we call a poem, will occur. That's what it is for me, Michael. And so it's not a matter of taking sensitivity training or something like that, but it's a matter of really being your full six or even possibly seven senses as a human being, alive moment after moment after moment in the present, so that you become a viable expression of that moment.
When I was reading last night the poems in Bright Root, Dark Root, I was stopped by the poem The Boat, which I thought was incredibly lovely, beautiful poem, and that I was reminded of a question that a mentor of mine once asked a composer, Morton Feldman.
Mm-hmm.
The mentor was, of course, Donald Barthelme, who's mm-hmm. often referred to in these precincts. Morton had written a poem that had tiny bells punctuating an ongoing silence, little chordal clusters of bells, more the echo of bells than bells themselves. It was a very delicate piece, and if you weren't listening hard, you wouldn't have heard it. You mm-hmm. know, it was barely there. And Donald, in the Q&A period afterwards, raised his hand and said, Morton, you're a large and not particularly tidy man, and yet your music is extremely discreet, ordered, and ineffable. Where has the mess gone? Mm-hmm. Where do you put your mess?
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself, as I read these poems, feeling that their delicacy is so extraordinary that I wondered, where does the grit go, and is it necessarily filtered from the poem?
Well, I don't think it is filtered. I mean, for example, you know, the image of the lotus in Buddhism is very important. It's the image of purity. But where does the lotus grow? The lotus grows in the mud. If there's no mud, there's no lotus. If there's no depth of feeling for me, there's no possibility of expression at all. Now, that depth of feeling is not filtered at all. I have dedicated myself as a poet in the world to feel to its fullest extent everything that comes through. I mean, I'm laughing inside now because a very dear and old friend of mine said to me once, you're not joining the men's movement. We don't want you feeling anything any more deeply than you do already. And it was a very true statement. And so because I'm able to feel all the shadow material, all the terror, all the fear, all the anxiety, all the devastation over the political and social situation in the world, over racism, over ignorance, over rape, because I allow myself to feel all of that, I also am able to feel all of the beauty in the world. A poet named Issa, who was one of the great haiku poets of Japan, described life as walking on hell, gazing at flowers. I walk on hell with the rest of us, but I see the flowers with the rest of us also. And I don't so much concentrate on one thing over the other as try to find the way in which they integrate for me. I am, by nature, I feel. and this goes into my poems, a survivor. A survivor of even the most terrible present moments. And I sing that celebration and I sing that praise. But you can be certain, as it says in this book, that at the root of brightness you will find darkness, just as at the root of darkness you will also find brightness, because it's life itself.
It seems to me that dualities and the unification of dualities are very important in these books, even in title alone, Bright Root, Dark Root, mm-hmm. or Two Bodies, Dark Velvet. I wondered, does a poem remain aesthetically incomplete if dualities remain unreconciled?
No. Because even if you have some notion of the absolute oneness of the oneness of the world is made of the discrete and separate entities of the world as well. And so it's perfectly natural, even right, if one can use that word, to have an unresolved issue, an unresolved expression, something that has not gone home, so to speak, because that is our world, that is our life. And there are poems in Bright Root, Dark Root, for example, that simply describe the awfulness and stop right there. And there are poems that resolve what we might think of as the awfulness what I just called going home, that expression of unification.
Going home, is that a formal is there a Chinese character for return?
For return? Well, it's very interesting. The sense of redemption in religion is about the return to one, of course. The fall in our tradition is out of one came the many. I mean, that's what the story of the fall from paradise is about. It's the alienation. And another way of talking about sin is the alienation from the one, or alienation from God. And the whole rest of human history is about the return to God, or the return to the source, the return to oneness. For me, the act of writing is actually an act of redemption. It's a way in which I don't plan, but find myself returning to whatever it is I am. And I don't mean to limit that to my personality, or as Bartleby asked, the mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, he felt that one of the important jobs of an artist was to make mistakes on paper, mm-hmm. and to leave them in, that there is always, he felt, that perfection did not belong to man, and that in the most skilled brushstroke, there would always be a dot or blot of unmeant paint. Mm-hmm. And so he always liked those elements of process that remained behind, although they were not necessary, in fact, were accidental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have quite a few words in my poems that I didn't mean to write. But somebody meant to write them, and they ended up making the poems better. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, I discover my mind in the act of writing, and so it's not. Not only do I rewrite infrequently, but I can honestly say I never know where I'm going from the word go. I haven't a clue, and in that way, you could say all my poems are accidents. And I trust, again, because I trust the process. This is what I'm interested in now, and this is what I'm interested in now. I haven't a clue as to where it's coming from or where it's going. And in that way, you can say, my poems are nothing but blots.
In what way, I know that for several years, there was a period when your work, when it appeared, was appearing in very small letterpress editions. Mm-hmm. Very beautiful, but very expensive books.
And inaccessible to even the poet.
In what way does publication act as a part of the process? Is it a completion? Is it a necessary act? Do you feel incomplete with a manuscript until it arrives? What is your feeling about publication?
You know, it's a very profound question, actually, because you're asking and questions about the nature of not only of the process of creation, but things that get mixed in from mm-hmm. ideas of success mm-hmm. and the nature of human appetite for acknowledgement, for recognition. That gets mixed in too. For a long time, I felt that publication didn't really mean that much to me. And I would often quote a Chinese phrase, which was, never offer your verses, but when asked, never refuse. I think that as I've grown inside of myself, I've been able to acknowledge that I certainly do write these poems for myself, but I also would like to give them as gifts to the world, because the world has given these poems to me as a gift, or at least that's how I see it. And so publication becomes necessary. I worry a little bit about the nature of the ego appetite that rises with the need to publish. On the other hand, who could blame anyone for wanting their work to be seen and acknowledged and shared and enjoyed? You couldn't. In my own mind and in the teaching that I do in my workshops, I don't stress publication, but I no longer shun it. I think that's a shift from the maybe the last conversation I had on KCRW with Jim Crusoe many years ago, in which I said, who cares? Finally, I think we do care. But if publication becomes the important part, I don't think you're going to write a good poem, because then your eyes are facing outward only, and you no longer have the kind of vision that you need to go to those deep places inside of you to be able to write the poem. And I sort of caution people against that sort of obsessive stargazing, I think of it as.
I'm talking to Peter Levitt, the author of Bright Root, Dark Root. I'm sure that I'm going to get calls after the show from people who are interested in finding out how one would go about studying with you. Can you obviate some footwork and tell me right now?
You mean you want my phone number?
I mean,
there's a process. I like to work with people who are sort of moving along on their own in their poetry, and I ask people to send me 5 to 8 poems in the mail, and then I read it and I see, because there are 3 different groups, which group of people the poet might benefit from. I think of the dynamic of persons in the room, because I only work with 10 people in a workshop. I won't go more than that. I can't concentrate at the level I need to concentrate on other people's work week after week after week. And so after that process, then people come into the workshop and we get moving.
I've been talking to Peter Levitt. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books.
Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. 2 FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.